Hello and welcome to Spoilers, this first introduction to the play The Life and Death of Jack Straw. Following are some introductory notes and a plain text recording of the dialogue, a plain text being the first cut edit of our full cast audio recording. It has all the text, but no SFX, no Foley, and it's the edit we use to hunt out textual errors, retakes, or cuts. So it's not perfect, and we may change the take and the text for the final thing. If you want to just enjoy our production, stop listening now and wait for the release. Or if you're listening in the future, look for the full cast episode further up the podcast list. Seriously, this is an exercise that some listeners won't enjoy. If it ain't for you, move on. But if you're still listening, let's enter spoiler land. Welcome to the spoilers for Jack Straw, Act 2, Scenes 2 through 5. Yes, I'm speeding up a bit, in part because all these scenes are interrelated, but also because they're super short. So in the last tiny scene with the goose, we've heard that the rebels are in camp. The leaders have gone off to see the king. Now in Act 2, Scene 2, the angry rebels come back on again from the meeting, which we discover never happened. So the gap between the two scenes requires an absence of action, which is then related by this scene and the next scene coming. Tom Miller enters again with all the rebels, their crew, Jack Straw leading, and he is mightily annoyed.
Here's a stir more than needs. What means the king thus to abuse us and make us run about his pleasure and to no end?
Naughty king, he didn't show up.
He promised us to meet us on the water, and by our lady, as soon as we came at the waterside, he fair and flat turns his barge, and away he goes to London.
It's all a little bit of Battle of Actium, the way he puts it, you know, the retreating king. Okay, I'm pushing that a bit far. Anyway, Jack is angry, and he turns to Wat Tyler, who we all know will turn up the heat.
I tell thee what, we will not put up this abuse.
By Gog's blood, Captain Straw, we will remove our camp and away to London roundly, and there we'll speak with him, or we'll know why we shall not.
God a mercy, Wat. And here we have done. We will be lords, every one.
So Jack has now reached the stage where he wants actively to take over the realm. From relatively earnest rebel via some looting and following the no-show of the king, an attempt at a full-blown takeover is now inevitable. Hob Carter, the leader of the Essex men, now says a little ditty. The verse written in very short lines, suggestive that this is actually a song, maybe a fighting song, all about the wonders of Jack Straw, building a myth up about him.
Gentle Jack Straw, in one line let us draw, and we'll not leave a man a lawn or a paper worth a whore, and make him worse than a door, that shall stand against Jack Straw.
Big roar from the men. I mean, this is not supposed to be high poetry. This is rough attacking street verse. Within this chaos is Sir John Morton, the man who set up the parley in the first place, and who is probably getting a bit of rough treatment. He's a brave soul to speak up now, as he does, in noble terms.
Methinks you might do well to answer the king in the name of the whole company, some dozen or 20 men for the nonce that may deliver the minds of you all in few words.
Sir John Morton, you are an ass to tell us what we have to do. Hold your prating, you were best.
I tell thee, Sir John, thou abusest us.
I would expect some blows happening here, maybe even more back and forth in the dialogue. The goading of Morton pays off later, so I suggest there was more material that maybe got cut here, because the scene ends with...
But let's to London as fast as we can!
Let the looting commence. Will you start the fans, please? And whoosh, we're over at the other camp. End of that scene, into the next. The king, surrounded by Archbishop, Treasurer, Secretary, Newton and Spencer, a random bargeman, makes a short, deeply unconvincing speech about why he didn't meet the rebels.
My lords, if all our men are common to the shore, let us return again into the town. These people are not to be talked withal, much less with reason to be ordered that so unorderly with shrieks and cries make show as though they would invade us all. I have not heard nor read of any king so ungently of his people entertained.
Yes, or in other words, I didn't panic, honest. So the king definitely seems like he bottled it, and now it's a bit of a shit show. So, exit the king. That's literally it from him. He makes his excuses for why he didn't do the thing he said he was going to do, and everybody follows him. Except for Sir John Newton and a chap called Spencer. Spencer is a bargeman who was busy with the oars during the events on the water. So he serves here as exposition feed.
Sir John Newton, what was the cause the king returned so soon, and with such haste so quickly took the shore?
Bargeman, the king had reason for the same. I warrant thee he was not ill-advised.
Huh.
The king had a reason, and it wasn't for lack of counsel, i.e. it wasn't our fault. Spencer, not privy to the plans of the great and the good, suspects the king wasn't supposed to have run away from the parley.
I think he meant to have commenced some talk with that unruly crew.
He meant so indeed, Spencer. But you heard how it fell out.
Not well. I held me stern so hard.
Oh, I was busy with the oars, Governor. Honest. You just tell me what happened. Because I was looking down. It was very, very hard work. Yeah, totally missed everything for which I was sort of privy to.
'Twas thus. The king and all his company, being rowed with oars so far as Greenwich Town. Oh, it was a world to see what troops of men, like bees that swarm about the honey hive, gan strew the gravel ground and sandy plain, that filled the air with cries and fearful noise. And from the water did an echo rise that pierced the ears of our renowned king, affrighting so his heart with strong conceit of some unhappy grievous stratagem that, trust me, with my ears I heard him say he thought they would have all like spaniels tear water desperately and boarded him. So did they all fare like frantic men. That time he thought to speed away apace and take the best advantage of the place.
Oh, how to play this speech by Newton. There are hints of some derision of the king. I mean, like spaniels is quite mocking. And yet Newton tends to be loyal. We decided that Newton is fiercely loyal to the king, but is deeply frustrated at his inaction. And by extension, the inaction of the Council of the Old Guard, the Archbishop, the Treasurer, etc., who got the king in this mess in the first place. So it's not that he isn't uncritical of the king's actions, but he knows that the king is but a young lad and he's surrounded by other councillors who are not Sir John Newton. The bargeman also can't wholly blame the boy.
Indeed, I could not greatly blame his majesty. Myself was not so scared this 7 years.
So, even though he wasn't really paying attention, the bargeman was also really scared at the time. There's a little bit with the bargeman of cake and having it at the same time. So, he's a really nicely defined character, though. I really like Spencer. I mean, he doesn't do very much, but he's that sort of workman like, no, I was just busy at the oars. What's going on? The next line, however, is a bit weird, and I don't really know what it means, apart from the sentiment that there's some bad stuff coming. It leads nicely into Newton setting up the looting of London and the chaos to come.
Methought there was sufficient months enough at highest tide to have drawn the Thames dry.
Spencer, ere it flow thrice at London Bridge, London, I fear, will hear of worser news.
Aye.
And they exit. And the dramaturgy of these two scenes is interesting. They all report an event we don't see after the fact. And I don't believe that any scenes of, you know, the running away of the king have been cut. I think this is a clear dramatic choice. We build up to a grand meeting, and then it just doesn't happen. and we see the consequences of that non-event, which is a really interesting thing. I like that. Also, this is the last time the text mentions the presence of the Archbishop or the Treasurer. The Archbishop will definitely be dead by technically the middle of Act 3, though if it were actually staged in this play, it would probably happen somewhere in Act 2, because that's where the medley of chaos is coming up. And it would probably be towards the end of Act 2, going into Act 3, though I believe technically it happened during the action in Act 3. I could be wrong about that, but I'm only just starting to look into the actual history of this play. I've deliberately not. I'm just trying to analyse the play, and then I'm going to come reverse engineer, look at how it distorts or elaborates upon the source material that the author might have looked at. But that's a future podcast coming much further down the line. Anyway, we hurtle now into scene 4. The crew of rebels, with Morton still, re-enter to attack the city. I don't know whether he's still technically being kept by them or whether Morton's just mentioned as being about. I don't know if actually he's about for the first half of this scene at all. It's perfectly plausible, but it might just be that he's assumed to be there in the interpolated stage directions for this edition of the play. Anyway, the crew, angry, are attacking the city with this cry of despair from the men of Southwark, which might be done chorus-like. I don't know precisely how this would be delivered, whether it's by single actor, by almost a chorus of terrified Southwark men. It is Southwark men plural. I couldn't satisfactorily break up the text into a number of individuals speaking lines after each other, so either a leader among the people or a group cry of despair.
Neighbours, you that keep the gates, let the king's liege people in, or we must be fain to aid them with balls of wildfire or some other device, for they have spoiled all Southwark, let out all the prisoners, broke up the marshalsea and the king's bench, and made great havoc in the borough here. Therefore, I pray you, let them in!
Let the rebels in. If we piss them off, we're screwed. And Wat Tyler throws in the cry to get on with it.
Porter, open the gate! If thou lovest thyself or thine own life, open the gate!
And Tom Miller, still smarting over his lost goose, hints at the fires to come.
You have a certain spare goose came in to be roasted. She is enough by this.
Yeah, we're going to be able to roast a lot of geese with the burning buildings that we're going to produce. And they all exit, presumably having gained entrance to the city. They have left or forgotten all about Morton, who is left to do a rather fine speech of despair over the self-harm England does to itself.
What means these wretched miscreants? To make a spoil of their own countrymen? Unnatural rebels! Whatsoe'er by foreign foes may seem no whit so strange as Englishmen to trouble England thus. Well may I term it incest to the land, like that foul, lawless force and violence which Cinyras did offer to his child.
So this is following Ovid here. Cinyras, having unwittingly committed incest with his daughter, she tricked him, bed trick, bit of business there. When he discovered it was she, he picked up his sword and offered violence there. She ran away and turned into a tree, as you do.
Oh, happy time, from all such troubles free. What now, alas, is like to be the end of this attempt? But that so long as they are glutted all with blood, they bathe therein.
So that's Morton speaking as the city is under attack, burning fire, alarum, noises. We're going to have fun with the soundscape on this one. And it's setting up the next horror in the next scene. Act 2, Scene 5. Enter Nobbs with a Fleming. Little boy Nobbs, here performing his first war crime.
Sirrah, Here it is set down by our captains that as many of you cannot say bread and cheese in good and perfect English, you'd die for it. And that was the cause so many strangers did die in Smithfield. Let us hear you say bread and cheese.
And the Flemish man says something close to bread and cheese, but it's no banana. And while the script does not say that he dies, this is a short depiction of an actual massacre of Flemish workers. So when he says,
bread and cheese,
he's dead. And it is Nobbs what kills him. So at the halfway point of the play, any hope of good coming out of this rebellion is as dead as this Flemish man. This is now a power struggle. It is an attempt to take over. It is no longer about redressing wrongs. The final end is not far away. But that's in Act 3. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of the rest of the second act, or if you have any disagreements with my thoughts, or if I'm in plain error, let me know. I might re-edit based on your suggestions. Email us at admin@beyondshakespeare.org or give us a buzz on Twitter @beyondshakes. Or you can support our work by becoming a patron. Patrons get to vote for the plays we work on next. Go to patreon.com/beyondshakespeare and get involved. But till then, here's the plain text of Act 2, Scenes 2 through 5 of The Life and Death of Jack Straw. Performed by Polly Hall as Jack Straw, Lee MacDonald as Wat Tyler, Hugh Wallapooley as Tom Miller, Andy Barrett as Hob Carter, Sarah Golding as Nobbs, Hayden McCabe as Sir John Newton, Geir Madlin as Sir John Morton, Nemone Stone as Richard II, Rob Meissen as Spencer, the Bargeman, and I've been your host, Robert Crichton. Enjoy.
Here's a stir more than needs. What means the king thus to abuse us and make us run about his pleasure and to no end? He promised us to meet us on the water, and by lady, as soon as we came at the waterside, he fair and flat turns his barge and away he goes to London. I tell thee what, we will not put up this abuse.
By Gog's blood, Captain Straw, we will remove our camp and away to London roundly, and there we'll speak with him or we'll know why we shall not.
God a mercy, Wat. And here we have done. We will be lords, every one.
Gentle Jack Straw, in one line let us draw, and we'll not leave a man a lawn or a paper worth a whore, and make him worse than a door that shall stand against Jack Straw.
Methinks you might do well to answer the king in the name of the whole company, some dozen or 20 men for the nonce that may deliver the minds of you all in few words.
Sir John Morton, you are an ass to tell us what we have to do. Hold your prating, you were best.
I tell thee, Sir John, thou abusest us. But let's to London as fast as we can.
My lords, if all our men are come unto the shore, let us return again into the town. These people are not to be talked withal, much less with reason to be ordered that so unorderly with shrieks and cries make show as though they would invade us all. I have not heard nor read of any king so ungently of his people entertained.
Sir John Newton, what was the cause the king returned so soon? And with such haste so quickly took the shore.
Bargeman, the king had reason for the same. I warrant thee he was not ill-advised.
I think he meant to have commenced some talk with that unruly crew.
He meant so indeed, Spencer. But you heard how it fell out.
Not well. I held me stern so hard.
'Twas thus. The king and all his company, being rowed with oars so far as Greenwich Town. Oh, it was a world to see what troops of men, like bees that swarm about the honey hive, gan strew the gravel ground and sandy plain, that filled the air with cries and fearful noise. and from the water did an echo rise that pierced the ears of our renowned king, affrighting so his heart with strong conceit of some unhappy, grievous stratagem that, trust me, with my ears I heard him say he thought they would have all, like spaniels, tearn water desperately and boarded him. So did they all affair like frantic men, that time he thought to speed away apace and take the best advantage of the place.
Indeed, I could not greatly blame his majesty. Myself was not so scared this 7 years. Methought there was sufficient months enough at highest tide to have drawn the Thames dry.
Spencer, ere it flow thrice at London Bridge, London, I fear, will hear of worser news.
Aye.
Neighbours, you that keep the gates, let the king's liege people in, or we must be fain to aid them with balls of wildfire or some other device. For they have spoiled all Southwark, let out all the prisoners, broke up the Marshalsea and the king's bench, and made great havoc in the borough here. Therefore, I pray you, let them in.
Porter! Open the gate! If thou lovest thyself or thine own life, open the gate!
You have a certain spare goose came in to be roasted. She is enough by this.
What means these wretched miscreants? To make a spoil of their own countrymen? Unnatural rebels! Whatsoe'er by foreign foes may seem no whit so strange as Englishmen to trouble England thus. Well may I term it incest to the land, like that foul, lawless force and violence which Cinyras did offer to his child. O happy time, from all such troubles free! What now, alas, is like to be the end of this attempt? But that so long as they are glutted all with blood, they bathe therein.
Come on, sirrah. Here it is set down by our captains that as many of you as cannot say bread and cheese in good and perfect English, ye die for it. And that was the cause so many strangers did die in Smithfield. Let us hear you say bread and cheese.
Bread and cheese?
Close.